Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
As part of our ongoing Protestant Reformation series, today we explore one of the unique long-term effects of Luther's spiritual revolution, and one that takes us in a seemingly secular direction, the rise of Nordic welfare states. To that end, my guest today is Professor Robert Nelson, a political economist and professor of public policy at the University of Maryland, who recently penned the book, Lutheranism and the Nordic Spirit of Social Democracy. Professor Nelson has an eclectic mix of interest, having published over 100 articles and book chapters on a wide variety of topics, such as local housing zoning laws, the regulation of public lands out here in the Western United States, social welfare polities in Europe, and the normative foundations of economics and environmentalism. Indeed, he was our guest on the show several years back talking about the religious nature of modern environmentalism, and we'll link back to that episode on our website. In addition to his many, many articles, he has written 10 books, including the one we've already mentioned on Lutheranism, as well as others such as God, Very Probably, Five Rational Ways of Thinking About the Question of a God, The New Holy Wars, Economic Religion versus Environmental Religion in Contemporary America, Private Neighborhoods and the Transformation of Local Government, and Economics as Religion, from Samuelson to Chicago and Beyond, to name just a few. Bob has written widely in publications for broader audiences as well, including Forbes, Reason, The Washington Post, The Wall Street Journal, and a variety of other newspapers and periodicals. He worked in the Office of Policy Analysis at the Office of the Secretary of the Interior from 1975 to 1993, has been a visiting scholar at the Brookings Institution, and a visiting senior fellow at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, among a number of other positions he's held over time. There's so much more to his biography that we will point you over to his website at the University of Maryland for you to peruse, so please stop by our website and get the link and check it out. Bob, welcome back to Research on Religion.
Yeah, well, it's great to be back.
You received your PhD in economics at Princeton in 1971. You spent a fair amount of time in the federal bureaucracy, and then you cut your teeth on land use and property rights issues. Now you just finished a book on the religious foundations and religious aspects of Nordic welfare states, not to mention other recent books on the similarities of economics and environmentalism to religious movements. My gosh, connect the dots of that 4.5-year decade trajectory for us, if you could.
Okay. Well, it's actually probably 5 decades, starting from when I entered graduate school in economics at Princeton in 1966. And I got my PhD in 1971, but on the whole, I found the experience a little disappointing. And I wasn't writing about it, but in my own cocktail party conversation, as we shall call it, I was saying that, well, economics certainly functionally behaves a lot like a religion, and its scientific qualities are overrated. And that was part of my decision to get out and move into the, eventually get into the Interior Department in 1975, where I stayed till 1993. The interior influence, though, was very important. I was involved in a lot of debates there as an observer and participant to some degree that were between economists and environmentalists. And by the mid-1980s, I was thinking that these debates had the feel of a religious controversy. I wouldn't actually write that out in great detail till 2010 in my book, The New Holy Wars, but I started thinking seriously about it, and then I started thinking that I should actually start trying to write something about it, since it seemed to be central to the whole policy-making process as I was observing it firsthand. And that led to my first article on environmentalism as a religion called Unoriginal Sin, the Judeo-Christian Roots of an Eco-Theology, which appeared in 1990. And then I had my first book, which was Reaching for Heaven on Earth, The Theological Meaning of Economics, which was in 1991. And then some of the books you mentioned, Economics as Religion, which was in 2001. And then the three more since then. So I've had a side. This has been an important part of my life, writing-wise, since basically 1990. At the same time, I've been pursuing a more conventional public policy career, which is why I'm located right now in the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland.
There are a number of interesting books that you have there thinking about economics as a religion, environmental as a religion, but you did write one book recently that the title is God, Very Probably. Give us a quick summary of that and how you came to that one, because it seems to be related yet a little bit tangential to some of the other writings.
Well, again, I think, you know, ultimately it stems from what you might call a deep curiosity on my part. And so I had, by the time I was writing that book, looked at economics as a religion, and basically found it pretty unsatisfactory from a personal point of view. And then I had looked at environmentalism as a religion and had the same reaction. I mean, as objectively, both of them were extremely important in terms of driving current events and contemporary thinking. But from an individual point of view, I thought they were lousy theology. So I thought that, I should start thinking about that question myself. And what do I actually think, theologically? And it was a pretty big leap for me to make, because now I was actually leaping into the realm of writing a book of theology, as opposed to a religiously oriented commentary on contemporary political, economic, environmental thinking. I started it in 2010, and it was published in 2015. And the question was just like the title, God? Very probably. I was sort of basically an agnostic when I started writing the book in 2010, and by the time I finished, I had concluded, as the title suggests, that the existence of a God is very probable. It's not necessarily the Christian God, so it's, in a way, it's a more abstract argument. Has more resemblance to something like Aquinas, for example, who wrote about God in terms of a first mover, which was well removed from the personal Christian God of his time and our time. And the reason that there are five chapters that give the reasons why I came to that conclusion. For one thing, I said right at the beginning that this was not a scientific question, so it could only be a question of estimating probabilities. But then I went through in each of these five chapters and showed why they all added to the probability that there was a God. The two most important chapters were where I discussed the workings of contemporary physics and its foundations in mathematics, and said that there was no scientific way to understand why mathematics was so successful in explaining the workings of the natural world, so it must have some kind of a supernatural explanation. That is, there must be some kind of God there. And I looked at human consciousness, and that was another major chapter, and said that human consciousness is scientifically inexplicable. There's, you know, some important recent writing along those lines, including a book by a leading philosopher, Thomas Nagel, and called Mind and Cosmos, but I drew on quite a bit of other literature as well and essentially said that human consciousness introduces another supernatural element into our existence and is another strong reason for thinking that there's a high probability of some kind of a God.
Interesting work. We will point back to that on our website for people to check out. But today we want to continue with our Protestant Reformation series as we have the 500th anniversary of Martin Luther's nailing his 95 theses up to the church door in Wittenberg. You wrote an interesting book that takes Lutheranism into our contemporary time, traces it back from its roots 500 years or so ago, and then notices the reverberations of its impact, specifically in Northern Europe, in a book called Lutheranism and the Nordic Spirit of Social Democracy. How did you come to write that book?
Well, there were multiple factors. I had a sabbatical in 2014, and I spent 7 months at the University of Helsinki. And I was always had a strong interest in the Scandinavian world because my mother was the daughter of two Finnish immigrants, and my father was the son of four Swedish grandparents, great-grandparents, or no, four grandparents. But what happened was when I got to Finland, I had, as I mentioned to you before, been thinking along these lines that belief systems like economics and environmentalism, which are conventionally regarded as secular or even, you know, a-religious, that they should and are properly understood as another form of religion. And using the term religion literally, not just in a metaphorical sense. And so I had explored this idea at great length, actually, for 24 years, but mostly focusing on the United States, or almost entirely. And so when I got to Finland, I said, well, you know, I've been looking at these things for 24 years now, and whenever I start looking at a secular belief system, which is playing a fundamental role in its society, I almost always find that it's a form of secularized religion, and that it has a fundamentally religious message, and that message is not just religious, but it's actually derived from Christian roots. It's a message of the story of history, from the depths of poverty and human corruption to the arrival of a new heaven on earth. And so I said that since that has so consistently proven to be true when I've looked at other so-called secular belief systems, let's start with the hypothesis that it's also true here in the Nordic world. And so that would be, what was the secular belief system that had driven the formation of the Nordic welfare state in the 20th century? Well, it basically was the belief system of social democracy. And so then I said, well, social democracy, by my reckoning, I should be able to trace similar roots in social democracy to original religious foundations, and here in the Nordic world, that would logically and necessarily be Lutheran foundations. So my hypothesis was derived from the previous work I had been doing, but I had very little exposure or knowledge personally to Nordic history or even to Lutheran religion. And so that required me to engage in a crash course of learning about these things. But then, as I did that, everything sort of fell into place. And I found out, for example, that there was actually, it hadn't started since the 1990s, but there was a new body of Nordic scholarship which rejected the traditional secular understandings of social democracy. And actually there had been a fair number, not a huge number, but a fair number of people who had written about social democracy in terms of its being a secularized Lutheranism and an actual religion in its own right. So a lot of the book consisted of drawing upon that writing, but nobody had actually written a full book to develop that theme. So this is, to my knowledge, the first full book and that actually develops that message, but it's informed by the fact that I had been writing about similar application, similar ideas, and had developed a whole way of thinking about the role of what you might call secular religion, or some people prefer to call it implicit religion, in modern theology, and that role was far greater than even most mainstream, at least American theologians, were recognizing, or mainstream historians and social scientists. So, in a way, what you could say is it was informed by this crash course of learning about social democracy and Lutheranism, but it was also informed by a way of thinking that I had been developing for 24 years up till then.
Now, we had talked earlier on your podcast on environmentalism as a religion about that term religion, and in that podcast you noted that you have a slightly different one that you might find in a religious studies department. It's a broader nature of how you would define religion. How do you define religion?
Well, I mean, one thing to recognize is that the definition of religion is very contentious. So there's no one accepted definition. I think that a lot of people who think about this question, who aren't familiar with religious studies and more, you know, developments in the contemporary world of theology, tend to assume that a religion has to have a god. And not only that, they tend to think that this god has to be quite like a Christian or Jewish god. I find that definition, along with a lot of other students of religion in the 20th century, to be much too narrow, and that there's a wide range of religions, and the best definition that I've encountered that of Paul Tillich, a great theologian of the 20th century, who defined religion as dealing with matters of what he called ultimate concern. But that didn't have to do with necessarily with a personal god. And Tillich examined different forms of belief in the 20th century that did deal with matters of ultimate concern, and some of them, or many of them, were what would have been more conventionally called ideology, but I call ideology an obfuscation for people who are uncomfortable with the idea of talking about these things as actual religions. And a good example would be Marxism, which, I mean, it's virtually every contemporary commentator on Marxism ultimately describes it as a religion explicitly. But there are lots of other ones, including things like the civil religion of the United States that Robert Bella wrote about. The civil is not as important to me. It means that it's not a traditional Christian religion, but it's still a religion. And if you look also at definitions, and these are all different by leading students of religion such as William James or Emile Durkheim, you don't find that they require a traditional god in a Christian sense to make something, or be able to say that something is a religion.
Now, not only do you take on the definition of religion here, you take on another term that becomes important in the book, and that's the Protestant ethic. And we hear a great deal about that this year because we are on the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation, and the Protestant ethic refers to Max Weber's famous thesis about the rise of capitalism. You point out immediately in the book that there really are two different Protestant ethics, and our focus on Max Weber's particular flavor of it is somewhat misleading, especially in the context of the Nordic states. So please explain that.
Well, there's at least two, and the ones that I examine in the book are, well, the one that I focus on in the book is what I call the Lutheran ethic. And I point out in the book, which is not in the least controversial. I mean, no student of Max Weber or his the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism would contest the fact that he's writing about Calvinism. And so he should have labeled, if he had been intellectually honest, the book should have been called The Calvinist Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. I don't know. He must have been concerned about sales or something like that, because he overstated the matter in calling it the Protestant ethic, but which has led to a great deal of confusion. I mean, some people over the course of the 20th century pointed out that, well, the characteristics that Weber spoke about don't characterize all Protestant countries, including the Nordic countries, which seem to have a different normative foundation. And so they took that as saying, oh, well, this is grounds for dismissing the whole Weber thesis. So Weber was responsible for creating a lot of confusion. And I'm hoping, or I think, that this book, will at least try to contribute in its own modest way to clearing up some of that confusion and saying, well, we should limit Weber's thesis to the Calvinist ethic. We should recognize that there's a Lutheran ethic which dominated the Nordic world, and there might be some additional Protestant ethics, like a 19th century Methodist ethic, but I have nothing to say particularly about that in this book.
Well, let's stick with the Lutheran ethic versus the Calvinist ethic, and you notice that the Calvinist ethic really it influences a lot of the Scottish Enlightenment, the United States, and throughout the book you make a few comparisons as you go through there. The Lutheran ethic, on the other hand, is one that is more central to the Scandinavian countries, Norway, Finland, Sweden, Denmark, and the like. You also take us back to Martin Luther's actual ideas about capitalism and markets. So give us a sense how the Lutheran ethic is different than the Calvinist ethic and Luther's thinking about economics and markets.
Well, part of the, at the center of Weber's arguments was the idea of a calling. And as Weber argued, even though the pursuit of a calling couldn't, and the success in a calling couldn't guarantee salvation, it could be a good indicator. And actually, a lot of practicing Calvinists took it as more than an indicator, and as something that, you know, it could become a version of, ironically, a Calvinist version of salvation by good works. But the key was that the Calvinist calling could be expressed, and it was expected to be expressed in the commercial realm and in business, and it was entirely acceptable that you should pursue profit and self-interest in the context of a Calvinist, the fulfillment of your Calvinist calling. And that you shouldn't get rich and then wallow in luxury, but getting rich and doing good things with your money was a very good thing to do. But in the Lutheran ethic, it has an equally powerful emphasis on a calling. This is where Lutheranism and Calvinism have a lot of Protestant similarities, but the specifics of the calling are quite a bit different in Lutheranism. Luther himself was hostile to self-interest and thought that that was, you know, that to give in to the pursuit of self-interest was to be antagonistic towards your own community and to do it harm. And so it shouldn't be encouraged. And Luther's sense of the calling, of an appropriate calling, was much more communitarian, and it was often summarized as that a Lutheran calling should be to be successful in the pursuit and acting upon the golden rule, which is doing unto others as you would have them do unto you. That's quite a bit different from what the Calvinist calling would recommend. And so that then has translated into the pursuit of callings in the Nordic world that involve social service and a strong sense of social solidarity. One of the things that people remark about who spend much time in the Nordic world is the very powerful sense among the people in these countries of social solidarity with one another and trust, and there's a much less individualistic orientation in the Nordic world than there is in the Calvinist world. A good example of that, which I didn't mention in the book, but I've since regretted that I didn't, is in Finland. They have what are called general rights for people in terms of their presence on private property. In Finland, you're allowed as a private individual to go on any private property as long as you don't interfere with the use of the property for farming or go too close to any physical structures. But the idea that we have in America that you should be able to own a large woodland acreage and put up no trespassing signs is completely rejected in Finland. And so in a certain sense, the woodland, except to the extent it's being used for farming or other specific purposes, is open access to everyone. And so that particular example contrasts the difference between a Nordic or a Lutheran ethic and a Calvinist ethic. The Lutheran ethic is more communitarian, more sense of a sense that we're all part of a group effort in taking care of ourselves. We should trust in each other. In these international surveys, the Nordic countries are outside, completely outside the range for the rest of the world in terms of the question, do you trust other people? So those are some examples. Then I list a number of other examples where Lutheranism leads in different directions than Calvinism, but there are some other ones where Lutheranism and Calvinism, as both forms of Protestantism, do have some common elements, which is that, for example, the importance of being able to read the Bible, which is both part of Lutheranism and Calvinism, and that has led to a greater emphasis on education from early levels to higher education in the Protestant world relative to the Catholic world, for example.
Well, one of the things that you point out is an interesting tension within Lutheranism, because Luther had four revolutionary points that included the freedom to pursue religious truth, the freedom of individual conscience, the freedom to live religious life at the highest levels, and the freedom of a congregation to select its leaders. And all these sound very individualistic as compared to the corporatist thinking of the Catholic Church that it was breaking away from. But you also note that Luther paradoxically defends strong secular authority that later on translates into the nation state. How are those tensions resolved within Lutheranist or Lutheran thought?
I would say not very well. And historically, the emphasis on individual freedom and conscience and other things rises from the earlier years of Luther's personal life, especially his defiance of the emperor, Holy Roman Emperor at Worms, where he said, "I can do no other," although he supposedly didn't actually say it, but it's gone down in history as him having said it, other than to believe, to retain his, you know, his own beliefs, and he couldn't violate his conscience. That was in 1521, I believe. And, but by 1525, things were becoming more complicated for Luther, because his ideas of freedom had been picked up and maybe misunderstood or misapplied, but had led to a mass peasants' revolt in Germany. And so Luther was forced by the circumstance to take sides, and he essentially took sides with the princes and the secular authorities, and encouraged the essentially encouraged the mass killing of the peasants who were revolting, and some of them thought they were doing it in the pursuit of his own beliefs in individual freedom and so forth. But anyway, Luther, from then on in his life, always defended the idea that there could never be a mass insurrection against secular authority, and that that kind of insurrection would be a mob, and a mob was worse than having to follow even the dictates of an unreasonable secular authority, and he defended that forever through till his death. And the other thing is historical, but anyway, the actual origins of Lutheranism in the Scandinavian world were where it was imposed from the top down. And so in 1527, Gustav Vasa, who the king of Sweden, basically expelled the Catholic Church. He was a predecessor in that regard to Henry VIII in England, and declared that henceforth the Reformation and Lutheranism would be the state religion of Sweden, and acted to make that happen. And then at that time Finland was part of Sweden, so that applied to Finland as well. And at the same time, King Christian in 1536 did the same thing in Denmark, and basically expelled the Catholic Church and declared that Denmark would be a Lutheran and a Reformation country. And again, Denmark was much bigger then. It included Norway and Iceland, and so it had wider repercussions than just the Denmark that we're familiar with today. So the history of Lutheranism, and this was based on one part of Luther's teachings, was of a top-down imposition. Whereas Calvinism tended to be much more bottom-up, and Calvinism spread among people, and then they would challenge authority, and sometimes they would even prevail, as in the English Civil War. So this is a significant difference.
Now, one of the interesting points you made in your book as well is you're talking about the Nordic states, primarily Denmark, Finland, Iceland, Norway, and Sweden. But Germany is, that's where Luther was, right? He was in Wittenberg. But Germany is not included in this, and they have a unique religious history that kind of takes them a little bit away from the direction that the Nordic states are going. Explain that a little bit.
Well, that's certainly the case. And I observed it just in passing that this issue could be brought up. And I said, though, that there was no I wasn't familiar with any generally accepted answer as to why the history of Lutheranism in Germany was quite a bit different in the Nordic than in the Nordic countries. I mean, just empirically, it's important, I think. Obviously, an important consideration is the fact that after the Nordic countries became Lutheran in the 16th century, they were almost 100% Lutheran. And whereas in Germany, there was always a large Catholic presence, there was always a lot of tension, even warfare, between the Lutheran North and the Catholic South and the Holy Roman Emperor. And so that has to be something to, you know, explaining some part of the explanation. But I have suggested that if somebody wanted to write a good book or do a good PhD thesis, trying to understand why Lutheranism didn't have the same effects in Prussia or in Germany. And of course, Germany didn't really come together as a nation until about 1870, as we know it now. But why the history of Lutheranism in Germany had different kinds of social outcomes. And, of course, part of the history, obviously, that people are going to want to bring up or would raise in any such context would be, well, how do we understand National Socialism? Now, National Socialism did not originate in Lutheranism at all, even though, I mean, it was actually in Bavaria, and Hitler was brought up as a Catholic. A lot of the top Nazis were brought up as Catholics. And but there seems to have been, once the Nazis came to power, the Lutherans were then put in the difficult position of how to understand what to do. And it was true that the message of Lutheranism, right going back to Luther, was that you should not rebel against your prince. And you could think your own private thoughts, but you shouldn't incite rebellion or participate in it. And so with Hitler was in effect the newest prince. And so Lutherans have been accused of not having done enough to stand up to him, probably with a considerable amount of justice. And in fact, some Lutherans even actively supported Hitler, which is not something that they would particularly want to remember at this point. But the German thing is just, all I would say is that it's complicated. There are also more Calvinists in Germany than in the Nordic world, where they were almost non-existent until the 19th century. And that would also be part of the overall story.
So let's now fast forward to the present day and take a look at the social democracies of the Nordic region. And this is where a lot of the interesting aspects of your book come, is that you're taking modern day social democratic thought, maybe over the past 100 years or so, and looking at its Lutheran roots here. But let's start out with some definitions here for folks that might not know some of these terms. What do we mean by social democracy? What's the general set of policies or institutions or ideas that define what a social democratic nation would be?
Well, at one level, you could say that it's the normative foundations for the development of the welfare state in the Nordic countries. So basically, the Nordic welfare state, as we're familiar with it, started to emerge in the 1930s, but really took off after the end of World War II. And then the welfare state continued to advance throughout the Nordic world until the 1980s, when then it started to come under challenge. Social democracy was also a political party. So the Social Democratic Political Party was the vanguard party for the development of the Nordic welfare state. And so it had its own history. And so the social democratic parties across the Nordic world started coming to power in the 1930s, and in some countries, such as Sweden, they almost totally dominated the political scene after World War II. But the evolution of the social democratic parties, a lot of them in the very early in the 20th century, were influenced by Marxist, more Marxist or old-fashioned socialist ideas that envisioned social the progress as occurring through class warfare, and that it was an vision in which the proletariat had to take charge of their own destiny and could expect to be resisted by other forces in society. A key to the success of the eventual success of the Social Democrats is that they jettisoned all that class warfare baggage gradually in the 1920s, and by the 1930s they had pretty much entirely jettisoned it, and they now adopted a view which was much more compatible with the Lutheran and the Golden Rule calling and the emphasis on a communitarian society where people helped each other. They called it at least in Sweden in the 1930s, that it would be the people's home. And so a key to that was that the Social Democrats accepted that the mechanism of political and economic change would be through parliamentary democracy rather than class warfare. And that was a much easier, or better, it was a much better idea all around, and was much more acceptable in the Nordic world from the 30s onwards. They also, and so it would be done through through parliamentary democracy, but the guidance for society would not be the proletariat intellectuals. The guidance for the development of the Nordic welfare state would basically be social science. So the experts in the Nordic world would be the economists and other social scientists. The political process would work in which people, the leaders of society, would be elected, but they would look to the expert social scientists for advice on how to conduct public affairs and manage the economy and provide appropriate education and all kinds of issues that any society would have to face. This would all be all these social scientists would be providing advice that would serve the fundamental goal of economic progress. And as I write in the book, I mean, the idea that economic progress would save the world, which is what the Social Democrats believed, replaced the Lutheran idea that ultimately the salvation of the world, or the millennium, Christ coming to earth, would depend on action by a Christian God. But there was still the element of salvation, but the mechanism of salvation, as proclaimed by the Social Democrats, would fundamentally be economic. And so the Social Democrats put a large emphasis on the reform of the economic system, the instruments of production, so that to maximize their efficiency, and in that way provide the goods and services which in the short run made it possible to have a very generous welfare state, and in the long run, as abundance spread across the Nordic world, would create what you might call a Nordic version of the new man that Marxism thought he was talking about, but had no idea how to get there.
Now, in your book, you document a lot of the aspects of the economic and political systems of these countries. It has a high level of political trust. There's high levels of what we call governance quality, which means there's not that much bribery that goes on. You've also noted that there's other measures in terms of standards of living, but also happiness indicators, where Denmark is the happiest country on earth by self-reported polls and that. Economists, and without thinking about the Lutheranism aspect of this right now, what are the common explanations for why these Nordic countries have done so well by all those measures?
And these measures are not just common impression. I mean, for all of these things, there are surveys that are done, like world value surveys or happiness surveys that are conducted by the United Nations that go all across the world. And the Nordic countries, in a number of them, gender equality is another one of these areas. Quality of governance, it's a survey, mass survey of the world done by the World Bank. In all of those areas, the Nordic countries stand out to an extraordinary degree. I mean, typically, at least four out of the five, and sometimes five of them will be in the top 10 in the world out of about 170 or 200 countries, depending on the specific survey. So it is actually really quite remarkable. And so the answer is that I don't think there is an answer that you can get out of standard social science. I mean, what the to the extent that they would say, try to explain this, they would say that something like that all of these things were some of the beneficial aspects of modernization and the development of rational ways of thinking about society and managing society, and that the Nordic world was more open to the forces of modernization, and associated with that, more open to following the dictates of rational analysis and economics and other social sciences, and actually bringing them into their governing systems in a way that they were more easily accepted and more generally accepted across the whole society, as compared, let's say, with the United States, where we had so many cross currents of opinion, and economists were always struggling to be heard against these other viewpoints and a skepticism of the experts, and that we see even in our contemporary life. That's somewhat more of a Calvinist way of thinking. Calvinism emphasizes, as I said, the bottom-up protest against the authorities, and starting with the authority of the Pope. But I don't think that anybody has really taken it much beyond what I just said. And so at some more fundamental level, you could say they don't have an answer. I mean, this maybe doesn't sound modest, but I would argue, and as I say, I'm not alone in making some of these arguments. I drew on an extensive recent literature in the Nordic of Nordic scholarship, but I'm basically offering, it's still a hypothesis in the sense that for it to be generally accepted, it would require more than just me to argue that it's persuasive. But this book is offering an explanation to your question that I don't think is out there. And part of the reason it's not out there is that the idea that the Nordic countries would be so fundamentally shaped by Lutheranism is still very difficult for contemporary American and European scholars to accept. There's still a fundamental secularism. These scholars have had to come to terms. They thought religion was going away. it's obvious even to them. And so historians and scholars now recognize that the idea that religion was going away was a big mistake. And it seems to be present, in fact, even maybe more importantly present now than it was 50 years ago, or definitely more importantly present. And but when, for them, the social, you know, the Nordic world and social democracy are the, their, those examples are supposed to be their best examples of the triumphs of modernization in the modern world. And to say that actually they were fundamentally shaped by Lutheranism is an awkward thing to say for them. And they also, for example, as I note in the book, people like Bernie Sanders, when he said he's a socialist, and they would, and then they would say, "Oh, well, do you mean the, you know, the ownership of the means of production?" He said, "No, I mean something like the Nordic world, or Denmark, in particular, was often mentioned." And Barack Obama once amusingly said in the White House that, being the president of the United States would be a lot easier if the United States worked more like a Nordic country. And if you, but so I don't think that those people, when they said that, there was no recognition on their part that what they were advocating is that the United States should become a Lutheran country. And the fact that the Nordic countries were grounded in Lutheran ways of thinking, it just doesn't fit the way a lot of our leading intellectuals think about the world, even right now. Even the ones who in concept think that religion is more important than the secularists of the 20th century thought, but when you put it as specifically as I'm doing and as I just did, no, they don't want to go there.
So take us through, if you could, some of the central tenets of Lutheranism that work their way into the social democratic ethos over the course of 300 to 400 years or so. You don't, your book lists a number of these. We already talked about some of the golden ruling and the golden rule and the idea of calling, but give us a general sense of what elements of Lutheranism made their way into social democratic thinking in Nordic countries.
Well, I gave a speech on this book, actually recently, August 23rd, at the School of Theology of the University of Helsinki, and I didn't have a list in the book. All the things were in the book, but they were scattered around in different places. But anyway, I listed 10 things, and so just to go through them very quickly, one is the idea that social democracy promises heaven on earth, but it's now through a secular economic progress rather than the actions of a Lutheran or Christian God. A second is that social democracy emphasizes human equality in a deeper way than almost any other nations of the world. And this is appropriately understood as a translation into a secular key of the Christian fundamental teaching that all human beings are made equally in the image of God. Protestants, including Lutherans, teach that the faithful of the religion consist of a priesthood of all believers. And so the idea of the division of society in Catholicism into ordinary lay people and then the religious elite is abolished in Protestantism. And that's reflected in the Nordic idea that the social democratic welfare state is, they call it the people's home, which could be interpreted as a secular reinterpretation of priesthood of all believers. And so they see all the members of society making a fundamental or deep religious commitment to participating together and contributing to the greater common good of the community, which was in Lutheranism, and it's also in social democracy. In fact, the title of this lecture that I gave is called From Lutheran State Church to Social Democratic State Church. Another one is the one that I already mentioned about the difference, the Lutheran calling, emphasizing the pursuit of the Golden Rule, which is at the heart of the idea of social solidarity, which is so conspicuous in the Nordic countries. Another one is one we've talked about, the Lutheran belief in individual freedom of individual conscience, and there's a similar social democratic commitment to free speech, freedom of assembly, and other secular free exercises of individual conscience. As we've talked about before, that runs into the paradox in Lutheranism of his embrace of state, power of the prince, but we'll leave that aside for a second. We talked about before the idea that Protestantism and Lutheranism in particular emphasizes everyone learning to read, which becomes, the Nordic countries are notable for their powerful commitment to education for all. Then there are many teachings in the Bible, which are incorporated into Lutheranism, which emphasize the importance of taking care of giving and giving to the poor, which is also part of Nordic social democracy, but not in the sense that you often find it in Catholicism, which taking care of the poor is through charity, whereas in both Calvinism and Lutheranism, there's a greater emphasis on providing education and doing other things that allow the poor to escape their poverty through their own efforts. There's the biblical tradition of the Ten Commandments, Nordic societies. The commitment to the rule of law is unusually strong in Nordic societies. When I was there, some Finns made a joke was that Finland and the other Nordic countries were the only ones that actually obeyed some of the crazy rules that were coming out of the European Union. Other countries just ignored them. And the last one I'll mention is that it's an application of the idea that all human beings are made equally in the image of God, but it's extended with greater vigor in Nordic social democracy to its implications for women and their unusually powerful commitment to gender equality. In fact, typically said to be in the Nordic world the greatest commitment, such commitment anywhere in the world.
One of the things that struck me as I was reading your book, you contrast a lot of this to the Calvinist ethos that you would find in the United States. But as I was reading this, and I'm reading this here in the Seattle area where we have a very big Scandinavian population, a settlement of Swedes and Norwegians, and debates on how you spell Olsen with an E or an O, but also Minnesota I kept thinking about as well as I grew up in the Midwest. Do you see any of these, this ethos kind of formulating itself in the United States too, whereas Seattle and Minnesota are very much more social democratic-y, that looks like the Nordic states as compared to, say, the Southern Baptists in Texas or Louisiana or something?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. It's rather obvious. I agree with you, or maybe I would go beyond you and say that it's hardly debatable. That's especially true of Minnesota, where a large number of the Swedes, especially Swedes and Finns, but also Norwegians, you know, went to Minnesota and have dominated or heavily influenced at least the culture of Minnesota. I mean, Hubert Humphrey and Walter Mondale would have fit quite well in a Nordic political context. And that Seattle, I mean, I actually lived in Seattle myself when I was growing up for quite a while. And but I would say that, yeah, the Pacific Northwest has some of that flavor in general. In you know, the parts of it west of the Cascades. And so, yeah, I agree with you. But I think it's one of the interesting things is, though, that whereas with some of our other religious groups, when they participate actively in American politics, they often emphasize the religious basis for their participation, like Irish Catholics or Southern Baptists. But you never really hear people who are espousing what are actually Lutheran values, but they never call them, you know, never say, oh, I'm an advocate for secular, I mean, for a secular Lutheranism or for the application of Lutheran values to American society. And it's interesting why that's the case. I guess partly, I mean, Lutherans are not as large. And numerically, I believe there's something like 4 million, that's the number I recall, in the United States. But anyway, there is in some areas clearly a Scandinavian Lutheran type of culture and influence.
Yeah, I bring that up in case there are any graduate students out there. You had mentioned that this book is really laying out some hypotheses and some ideas that should be subject to some further testing. So any entrepreneurial graduate student out there might want to pick that up and run. And
yeah,
an interesting comparison would be here in the United States.
I don't think anybody's really, I mean, again, I haven't spent my lifetime studying all of this. But I can't think of a book that I encountered which was, essentially, well, that met the highest, very high standards of scholarship and was about the Lutheran immigration to the United States. And again, though, it might be complicated by the fact that such a large part of the Lutheran immigration to the United States was German. And that became particularly dicey.
Yep.
In periods like World War One or World War Two, and so it might have, that I mean I'm thinking aloud now right now as we speak that might have been one reason for the wider reticence of Lutherans to advertise their Lutheran religion in the United States.
Some interesting stuff to be further focusing on there. Let me leave you with one question here today. You had talked about the rise of the welfare state in the Nordic countries from the early 1900s to 1980s, where it really starts to come under scrutiny and contention. Where do we stand today with the Nordic social democratic system? I know a few fair number of intellectuals and pundits advocate that the U.S. adopt such a system and that there's a rather technocratic and supposedly value-free notion underlying all these appeals. But are people starting to recognize its Lutheranism appeal? Is it starting to wear thin? Are we starting to re-envision the religious roots of some of this? Where are we right now?
Well, the social democratic parties have dramatically weakened the parties since the 1980s. I think in they're having trouble even, you know, beating out Finland has a version of the same kind of nationalist populist party that we're seeing arising in other parts of Europe. And so the Social Democratic Party, something about its roots is not succeeding or not prevail. You know, it doesn't seem to maintain the same kind of hold on public thinking that it had from about the 1930s to the 1980s, and you're seeing the rise. This is what we talked about to some extent in the previous podcast I did, of groups like environmentalists, who, you know, can be saying many things, and in Europe, the Green Parties, and there's a very strong strain of environmentalism which challenges the idea that economic progress is the salvation of the world, which is, as I said, was at the core of social democratic thinking in its heyday. And it's also been important, in the American civil religion that Robert Bella wrote about so famously. But we're also seeing here, even, with Trump, this populist rise, which is also, as I said, occurring, rather widely in Europe at this time. And with the Brexit vote also. The Brexit vote was a vote against the kind of universalist aspirations that put its faith in modernization and modernism and science and social expertise and all of these things. And so there's been something that's been happening since the 1980s, which is changing a lot of the assumptions that people were making up till the 1980s about where the global system was headed and the merits of the global system, and that with continuing rapid economic growth, it would mean that countries behave more democratically and more peaceably and other things like that. When you look at China, for example, the assumptions about the role of rapid economic growth and its impact on society don't seem to hold up very well. And so it seems there was maybe some fundamental misconception involved in how economic growth would affect a country. And that, in fact, much of what the Scandinavian world was imagining, that they imagined it could be projected universally, but it actually really was economic growth in the context of a society of Lutheran values. And since Lutheran values didn't prevail over most of the rest of the world, the consequences of economic growth over the rest of the world were a lot different than they were in the Scandinavian societies. And but the other thing that's happened is that another thing which has eroded confidence is that the Nordic societies have had trouble maintaining the very rapid economic growth. I mean, the period from 1950 to about the early 1980s was a period of very rapid growth in these countries. And so that one of the keys to the welfare state was that they had a lot of resources to distribute, and they didn't have to take it away from some people and give it to others. So all of these things. But then since like the Great Recession, I mean, economists didn't really, cover themselves in glory in predicting it, or even knowing what was going to happen after it, or how to get out of the economic hole that we had dug for ourselves. So there's also, has been a general decline in faith of professional expertise, and since that faith in professional expertise was so much part of social democracy, that's been an eroding force.
Well, definitely some things to be looking forward in the future, and it's a really interesting book that you've written here that blends the ideas of Lutheranism with our modern contemporary public policy realm, and seeing how those two trace together. So, excellent book. My guest has been Professor Robert Nelson. Bob, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To
learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.